And I'll never forget the headline in the Phoenix Business Journal. It was like, crazy California investor, he pays record price for property. It was a 220-unit building right in the Biltmore District. Beautiful property. The headline 5 years later was, crazy California investor, not so crazy, sells for record price. Every deal we've done has turned out better than we budgeted. As it turns out, the rents started at about $1.35, you know, and grew from there. Mark Taylor, who's a big developer in that area, started to build a project about 2 miles from ours, which didn't make me feel bad. It actually made me feel real good. If you wait for things to look perfect, you're probably too late. You can very easily go out of business by being too aggressive. And, you know, the way a lot of private equity deals have been structured over time, the developer makes his money if the project is successful. He doesn't lose a whole lot if the project isn't successful. If I didn't want to take risk on the leverage side that didn't match the type of investment it was.
Mike, welcome to Real Estate Development Land to Legacy. I've got you by in front of me, COO of a family-owned real estate powerhouse with 13,000 units, chairman of Guardian Net Lease Fund, licensed attorney and broker, over $3 billion in deals. I mean, at this point, you've probably had more closings than most people have had dinners. What am I missing?
Well, not a lot, but I got started in this business early on. My dad and I bought a six-unit apartment building in Ann Arbor where I was going to school and learned what it was like to be a landlord and have to be a leasing agent, a maintenance foreman, and everything else at the same time. Took that experience into being a real estate lawyer. When I moved out to Los Angeles, was doing a lot of land use and real estate work. Decided pretty quickly that I like to be on the other end of the deals, not on the legal side of the deals. At that point, went to work for my then father-in-law, helping him run his family office. At the time we started, we had about 2,500 units. He had never heard of a 1031 exchange before. I quickly introduced that to him. And if you think back, and this is the early 90s, we owned property in some of the hot spots of California, like Cerritos and Hawthorne and San Bernardino. And I say that tongue in cheek. At the same time, he was starting to buy in Texas when you could shoot a cannon through Texas and not hit anything. People don't remember that now, but in the late 80s and early 90s, Texas was not what it is today. And we started looking at our portfolio and said, you know, why are we owning these properties in California that are at best C properties and maybe worse when we're buying A properties in Texas and we're getting the same cash flow and we can have a better portfolio and we can have better properties and better locations. And so we started slowly to trade out of California to the point that today, we don't own anything in California. Everything we own is in Texas and Arizona.
Yeah, that sounds like where the market is growing the most, and that's where the most opportunities have been over the last several years.
We started in Texas. We owned a couple properties in the greater Houston market. And I'll leave that as the very greater Houston market. They weren't really great properties. We ultimately ended up selling out of there, but bought a lot of properties in Dallas and San Antonio and Austin. Really enjoyed those. Still have a very big presence in Dallas and San Antonio. A little less so in Austin. It's gotten a little more difficult to do work there, but still like it.
After all the Californians moved there?
Yeah. Then we started to go to Arizona and the greater Phoenix market. And I'll never forget the headline in the Phoenix Business Journal. It was like, crazy California investor, he pays record price for property. It was a 220-unit building right in the Biltmore District. Beautiful property. The headline 5 years later was, crazy California investor, not so crazy, sells for record price. And we ended up selling the building to a condo converter who paid top dollar for it. It was that kind of property. You know, that was our entree into Phoenix. And that just sort of accelerated our exodus from California, largely because, you know, and this will date myself, but we were looking at deals in California that were 6-cap deals, and we could get the same property for an 8-cap in Arizona. Now, people listening are probably saying, where did you get those cap rates? But that's what it was back then. And we just looked at the deals and said, we're getting the same cash flow on a better property. Why not? And we ultimately sold our California portfolio and started buying, and eventually, in a sideways sort of way, got into the development business. We owned a property in North Dallas that had 230 units and about 15 acres that we own right next to it. And we tried for about 4 years to sell those 15 acres to somebody. And there was always a problem. There were cross easement issues. There were all sorts of things that single family developers didn't want to deal with. Part of it was in a floodplain, which turns people off. And ultimately, we just said, well, you know, we know how to do apartments. Why don't we build some more units? And that's sort of how I got into the development business. Excuse me. You know, we started and I had to start from square one. I had to hire somebody. I mean, that was my first job. I had to hire somebody who knew more about development than I knew about apartments. And we hired that guy. And I'll never forget, you know, you talk about mistakes you made. I had hired an architect who I won't even name. He's since passed away, but he was notorious as being a marketer. And the first thing my new guy did was put the plans and the legal descriptions and everything into his system. And he said, Mike, I don't know how to tell you this, but the four walls of the building don't meet. If you put all the measurements together, you're not going to have a complete building. That was my introduction to development. We quickly got rid of him, hired another architect who cleaned up the plans, built the project successfully. We had another property in San Antonio, same thing. We owned 12 acres next to a 328 unit complex. We were able to build a couple hundred acres. That was successful. And finally, probably mid-90s, we said, you know, we're getting pretty good at this and it's worked out. We built some nice things. Why don't we just start looking for land? We can build the same project that we would buy. We know what the cost is going to be. We don't have to compete with all these other people to try to buy the asset. And we can build exactly what we want. And that's really where we started. The first project, Villas of Vista del Norte in San Antonio, was a beautiful 20-acre property on a hillside. We had to carve up the hill, but we were able to do things like create an infinity pool at the clubhouse and a lot of fun stuff. It was backed up to a lake and we were off and running. That was the way it went for us.
Amazing. Let me go back to the architect and the switch of the architect. So I've considered replacing an architect several times on previous jobs. And every time, we've actually done it once, but it is not an easy thing to do. Can you tell me more about that process? There's a number of issues from liability to copyrights to you name it. How did you go about this process and what did you learn from it?
Well, you're 100% right. It's a very difficult process to go through and you have to be extremely careful if you're going to do it midstream. In that case, we were lucky. We were only in the construction drawing phase and it was easy enough to hire another architect who, yes, we had to pay more. We had to pay for somebody to scrub the plans to be able to put their name on it. But we hadn't yet broken ground. So we weren't in a stage where a new architect is going to look at it from all the liability standpoint and be much more reserved about wanting to get involved. We have brought in, when we've had problems, we have brought in consulting architects to look at things that somebody's done just to say, look, no offense, but we want a second opinion. We think there may be a problem. I want to make sure the building is standing long after I am. And we want to be sure that everything's being done right. And we've done it on that basis. But it would have been much harder had we been under construction. Because at that point, you either waive the liability for the new architect or you're pretty much not going to get a new architect.
How did you go about the issue of copyrights? The previous architect typically owns the design. And if they're not willing to let it go, they could make it very difficult.
Not with us, they don't. That's one of the things I learned very early on in the process. The gentleman who's our project manager taught me a lot of this stuff, but we learned very early on, architects like to own the plans. We insist that we own the plans. What we will do for them, because they don't want us to take their plans and use them on another project, which raises potential liability issues for them, we'll agree that we won't ever use these plans on another property, or if we do, that we waive any liability against them for having done so. But we insist that the plans are ours. We do that with engineering drawings and everything else, because if for that very reason. I don't want to get into an argument later if something happens and I'm stuck because you own my plans or my building. For us, that was always untenable. It depends on deal size. We can get away with it because we're writing pretty big checks for pretty large complexes. If you're building 10 units, 12 units, you can ask, you may be successful, you may not be. It just depends on the leverage you have and how willing the architect is to give in. I was reminded when I was visiting with a friend who's in the development world as well, you know, you use the AIA agreements and, you know, the A in the AIA is architect. It's all built around protecting architects. I understand it. They're holding their neck out for everybody to look at. Ultimately, they're responsible. So you have to be careful with it.
Right. Yeah, no, very good advice. In my experience, it's difficult to convince an architect to not own the plans. Typically, we say that we get an unlimited license to use their plans. And as you said, yeah, if we decide to use that plan on another project, then we waive their liability. But it still becomes tricky. We once joined a development midstream. The owners already hired an architect. We started working on the project. We had some friction with the architect. We said, let's see if we could change teams. And the original architect put up a fight. And yeah. At that point, we had to make a decision. Do we persevere and figure out a way to switch the team? Or do we work out an agreement, a deal with an existing architect? And we ended up sticking with the original team. But yeah, it's not easy. It could potentially delay the project.
I mean, we just had, it wasn't an architect, it was a civil engineer. But we bought the project we're developing right now, 760 doors. We agreed to build the infrastructure for the bigger project of which we're a part. And we quickly found out that there were a lot of issues with the civil engineer's drawings. He had missed scale. He had missed the requirements of the town for how deep the asphalt had to be and a bunch of other things. And I would have loved to have jettisoned them right then and there, but we couldn't. You're talking about having to go back to the city and get a new set of plans approved by them or a new civil engineer. And the time is more valuable than just working through the issues. So we ended up working through the issues with the existing civil engineer. But, you know, it was a little painful.
Right. All those lessons that you learned along the way. So you already owned a number of buildings before you decided to develop. And if I understood you correctly, you thought that this would be a way for you to control the costs and to get a building at a better price than just buying an existing acquisition? Was that the motivation?
That was largely the motivation. We always figured that we could build it less expensively than we could buy it. And in doing that, we were getting a brand new property as opposed to one that was even 2 or 3 or 5 years old. The family patriarch didn't like getting into the negotiations that have become commonplace to buy property where you throw numbers out and then they come back to you. You know, we want a best and final and you're negotiating against yourself. And when we realized that the prices we were building at were as good as what we were buying, we just said, why not develop? It just makes more sense. We have the added advantage, though, because we're long-term owners. So we're building these projects for our own portfolio. I don't have to be, and don't take this the wrong way, I'm always very concerned about costs. But I don't have to be as concerned as somebody who's doing this on a private equity basis or is looking to flip the property where, you know, right now, for instance, the interest rate is taking away all the profit from merchant builders. They can't make their carried interest, get any number at the back end that's going to make the deal make sense because interest rates are too high. We look at it differently. We look at, you know, what's our cap rate going to be when we build this? Is it a little better than what we could buy for? Sure. Does it take into account the development risk? A little bit. Every deal we've done has turned out better than we budgeted. You know, every deal has come in. I mean, we underwrite the deals very conservatively. And when we feel that we can make money at those conservative numbers, we'll go ahead. You know, in all but maybe one of the deals, we came out substantially better than what we had originally forecast. And the one deal is pretty much on par with what we forecast. But I don't have to worry about my premium, you know, what I'm going to make out of the deal because I just built a brand new property. I've got the cash flow and that makes us happy. it's an entirely different way of looking at things, but it's helped us build when a lot of people would be more inclined to buy. They don't want to wait 2 years, 3 years to get a project. They want it today. They have money they need to deploy. We can, we can deploy our cash as we go. It's a lot easier and a lot less headaches. If I miss the market and I really don't get the rents that I thought I was going to get, every 12 months I get to mark my rents to market. And I don't know whether it's going to be a year or 2 years or 5 years, but rents haven't gone down over time. That, and with the scarcity of apartments, they're unlikely to.
How do you factor in the risk? Because that's typically the biggest driving factor. When you're buying an existing building, it's already there. When you're building from scratch, first of all, it's the time. It could easily take 5 years to get it done by the time you're done designing, permitting, building, stabilizing. It's a five-year cycle. So how do you value that risk of what's going to be 5 years from now compared to buying an existing building today with most of those variables figured out?
We do a lot of research. We do a lot of market research. We do it both on a micro level and on a macro level. Our developing in Phoenix now, as opposed to San Antonio, is directly driven by what we see as being, and I don't mean to suggest San Antonio is a bad market. We still really like it. But we see Phoenix as a faster growing market, more likely to absorb all the units that we're building and others are building. And we get comfortable with where the markets are and where we think the rents will. I make the argument that everybody who thinks that they're avoiding that risk, buy an existing building, look around and see where the nearest open land is, because that's going to be your competition and it will have an impact on your rents downstream as well. If we like the location, we'll start doing the market research to get comfortable as to what we think the rental rates will be. And at the same time, we'll look at what we expect the construction costs to be for that project. There's only been one time that we've done this where we literally were building a project in an area that had had no new construction in a long time. We underwrote the rents extremely conservatively. I think the market, it was in Mesa. The market, if you went outside a ways, was probably $1.20 a foot at that point in time. We underwrote this deal at $1 a foot and said, will it make sense at $1 a foot? If I've got that much, if I've got 20% margin, I can feel pretty comfortable about the development risk. As it turns out, the rents started at about $1.35, and grew from there. Mark Taylor, who's a big developer in that area, started to build a project about 2 miles from ours, which didn't make me feel bad. It actually made me feel real good that if they were willing to do it, either they thought we were brilliant and were following us, or more likely they had done their research also and decided that this area really could benefit from some new housing and it made sense. But that's how we deal with the risk. It's really in the underwriting of the deal. I don't look at the risk necessarily from the development standpoint. I think that's largely controllable. We know going in, we tend to work with the same general contractors. Everything we build in Phoenix has been with the same guys. They know what I'm thinking before I even open my mouth, and that helps. We'll look at other things, but that by and large gets us comfortable. And the lease up, again, it's a question of how fast or how slow is it going to be. There are always people who want to be in brand new buildings. I don't understand it. They're moving in while construction is still going on, but there's probably 40 or 50 units that you can count on people are going to lease because you're the newest apartment on the block and they just want to be the first tenant in that unit. And, as I used to joke, I've never seen a property not lease up. It's just a question of at what rate does it lease up? And that's really where we are.
Right. What do you think about this debate that's been going on, especially in the last couple of years as interest rates started rising and many institutional investors shy away from investing in development because the argument is that you could buy an existing building for less than the replacement cost. Construction costs are still going up. There's still distressed assets that could be picked up. New construction buildings where merchant builders, as you mentioned before, are struggling to refinance them. You could buy an existing building for less than what it would cost you to build a new one. Yeah, what's your opinion?
I think right now that probably is true. I've got enough gray hair to have been through three or four cycles and seeing how things play out. And the old adage that history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes, is generally true. There's always been times like this where you could probably pick up deals less expensively than what it would cost to build. The question is, what deals are you getting? What deals end up on the table? I remember through the great financial crisis, cap rates went up, values went way down. Well, that was true if it was one of the properties that was selling, but there were very few properties selling. The guys that didn't have to sell weren't offering their properties, and usually those were quality properties that you'd want to own. The ones who were up for sale were the ones that were distressed or having problems or had financing issues. Over the next couple of years, we're going to have all this financing coming due, and if interest rates stay where they are, there's going to be a bunch of distressed properties coming on the market. Have we seen that yet? In a small way, I think we have. In a large way, I don't think so. I was talking to somebody that I know who runs a opportunity fund. And he was bragging about all the money he raised, you know, money I'm trying to raise for other things. And he's like, yeah, he goes, we're going to get these deals. He goes, you know, I said, well, how long have you been at it? He said, a year and a half. I said, well, what have you bought? He said, well, nothing. What are you waiting for? I mean, at some point, you know, I always tell people you need to be a little ahead of the curve. If you wait for things to look perfect, you're probably too late. And, you know, we just came out of, you know, from 21 to 23 or so, we came out of one of the most dynamic apartment markets that I think I've ever seen. As a matter of fact, certainly that I have ever seen. And that dates back to the 80s. And a lot of that was, we were supply constrained during COVID. People didn't want to move during COVID. So that creates an artificial occupancy. You don't have the turnover, so you don't have the same units to lease, which just drives the rental rates up. And we came out of a very high market for multifamily. We've since fallen back to, as you stated, a point now where I think you could buy something if you can get what you want below what it would cost to build. The project we're building, I think we're pretty close. I think at the end, it'll probably be a little less than what it might have taken to buy that project. But again, I'll have a brand new project and not one that's 2 or 3 or 5 or 15 years old. And, you know, as projects age, they have a maintenance cycle. All the components in those buildings that I have brand new, you know, after 10 or 15 years are aging out, and you're replacing HVACs, you're replacing water heaters, you're, you know, windows start to leak. You have all the issues that go with that. And those properties, while you could probably buy them for competitive prices, may not sustain the maintenance costs over time that a brand new property will. So it's a close call. If somebody said, I want to go buy property, I don't want to build, I'd say, I can buy that argument. I mean, right now, I think is a wonderful time. I think as soon as interest rates start coming down, and I don't know what the Fed is doing, I think by next May, we'll have a different interest rate environment for sure. But I think as soon as interest rates start coming down, you're going to see a lot more activity. And that dynamic is probably going to flip.
Interesting. So speaking of interest rates and that downside protection, how do you make sure that by the time you're finished construction, because most construction loans are variable rate, but they also have a short term, how do you ensure that by the time you're done, you're able to refinance and pay off your construction debt?
There are times when having a really good balance sheet helps. And the problems that we face are a little different. Refinancing is one of many refinancings that we have to do over time. We don't look at it specifically as, okay, what's this going to look like? Can I take out the construction loan? We're pretty conservative in our borrowing. So we'll do the deals on 50% loan to cost. Not a lot of people can do that. And I recognize that. So I'm not as concerned if I miss my mark on the rents and what people look at. Most lenders will come to us and want to lend us money anyway. But having said that, you know, we're still managing the interest rate risk. I'm just managing it over a larger spectrum. So I'm trying to find, you know, this project we're building right now, we're building on balance sheet, but we're using some existing buildings that don't have financing to take cash out as we need it. And we've been lucky in the way we ladder our financing. In other words, we try to make sure that we don't have too much debt coming due at any given point in time, so that if we happen to hit a cycle like this, we might have to take out some loans that are higher than we'd like. but it's not going to be the sum of our portfolio. It's going to be a small piece of our portfolio. In this case, it happened to be that. You know, if you have a lot of debt coming due and you hit a thing like this, yeah. And a lot of people are seeing that right now. I talk to friends who are investors who are in deals and are saying, yeah, they keep coming to me wanting more cash. Well, that's because they thought that interest rates were going to stay at 2 or 3% forever, and they didn't. And now they're stuck. And now things are upside down, and they had 80 or 90% leverage. And they, you know, have to deal with that reality. We try to manage around that by being conservative. And, you know, you're never going to go out of business by being too conservative. You can very easily go out of business by being too aggressive. And, you know, the way a lot of private equity deals have been structured over time, the developer makes his money if the project is successful. He doesn't lose a whole lot if the project isn't successful. The investors, on the other hand, are in the opposite position. And I would suggest on the development world, there's a conflict of interest there between what the developer wants and what the investors may ultimately want. And you're seeing it now. I mean, you're seeing it with the deals that, like I said, had 3% financing, and now they're looking at 6-7% financing. That's true of existing properties as well as development. The only risk in development is that ultimately you've got to fill that building up before your construction loan runs out, a little more unpleasant with
life. Right. So deleveraging is an attractive concept. 50% loan to cost ratio is great because your risks are low, because you can always have that runway to refinance. But when you're talking to investors, how do you justify it to them? Because with 50% loan leverage, their returns aren't as high as
sure.
potentially other riskier investments. How do you communicate that to investors, that risk versus reward?
In this case, it's a different approach because all of our money is internally generated. We don't go out to market to get investors. As an example, the fund I'm doing right now in the single tenant net lease space, we're doing 65% leverage because we had to find a leverage number that would have an attractive return for the investors. I didn't want to go too far because I didn't want to face the problems ultimately, particularly because what we're doing is a relatively safe, stable platform. So I didn't want to take risk on the leverage side that didn't match the type of investment it was. But even at that, you know, 65% produces a better return than 50%. 75% would produce an even better return. And, you know, we've looked at it in terms of preferred equity to take up another chunk. And it's really attractive if you do well. It's not real attractive if you don't do well. And that's a decision that every developer has to make. That's a decision every investor needs to make. For us, you know, on that side of the house, we looked for a leverage that could produce the kind of return that we thought would be attractive to investors without taking on excessive risk. I could promise a lot more. Might I deliver it? Yeah, I think I probably could, but I don't want to promise something that I don't think that I can definitely get to. And that's about
interesting. But so you think 65% is a better blend of versus reward?
I think that's what I would consider to be the safe play. 50%, I acknowledge, is exceptionally safe. But, you know, I'm dealing in a different environment. If I were to take the portfolio and go raise money to buy the portfolio, I would probably be more on the 60-65% range because I think that would drive the return numbers to a point that would make investors happy. To me, 65% is sort of, there's a lot of lenders that will lend at that rate, 60-65%, and it's comfortable for them. It's comfortable for me as the sponsor to do it at that rate. And I think at the end of the day, the investors aren't going to get the call in the middle of the night that, hey, I need more money because we need X, Y, or Z on the property.
Thank you. That's good advice. Tell me a little bit more about this fund that you're fundraising for. What's this whole thing about net lease?
Sure. No, the concept actually is fairly simple. We're looking at high credit net lease retail, single tenant building. Think 7-Eleven, O'Reilly, Starbucks. Everybody's seen them driving down the street. Everybody knows who they are. We decided, you know, and I wanted to launch my own private equity group to put together deals and do things. And this being our first offering, we wanted it to be something that was A, easy to execute, B, fairly simple to understand, and C, something that I felt very comfortable I could do what I said I was going to do. So we looked at only high credit tenants. And the ones I ticked off, you know, the example I use is Walgreens was one of our preferred tenants. They're not anymore. Thankfully, we haven't bought any. Their credit rating started to diminish with all the debt they took on. They got bought out by Sycamore Partners and taken private, so they really fell off of our criteria anyway. We added Sherwin-Williams and Tractor Supply as two other very high-quality businesses. We looked at them and said, okay, we want them to be neighborhood businesses, things that are relatively Amazon-proof, so they're not going to get swallowed up by the, you know, 2,000-pound gorilla. We also wanted them to only be credit tenants. I didn't want to take on the underwriting risk of private companies or ones that were further down the food chain that, you know, think 99 cent stores. They were, now they're not, and they're vacant buildings. We didn't want to face that problem. So we said, we're just going to do credit tenants. That puts us apart from everybody else operating in this space. The best of the REITs, Agree Realty, Store Capital, you know, on the private side, Blue Owl, those guys, they're the best of them are about 65% credit. We said, no, we want to be 100% credit. And to me, I'm really only giving up maybe 25 basis points to get that credit. And to me, that if I'm doing something safe for a quarter of a point, why not really be safe? So we're looking to buy these stores. We're looking to raise $100 million. We're looking all across the Southwest. Again, all the markets, Southwest, Southeast, Central, Midwest, all the areas that we see are as being growing, vibrant environments, growing populations, areas where retail, that kind of retail is going to do very well. And, you know, we've penciled out a nice little 5 to 6.5% cash flow for the investors, payable quarterly. Really nice tax advantages given that the new one big beautiful bill passed with the 100% bonus depreciation. You know, we bought our first three properties at the end of last year. The investors who put in $250,000, which is our minimum investment, got a K-1 with a $140,000 loss. And that's just from, and that was the 60% bonus depreciation that was in play in 24. Now it's back up to 100. The real impetus is that this area tends to be the most highly correlated to interest rate of any of the real estate categories. It's something like 0.79% correlated, which means that if you believe, as I fervently do, that we've reached the top of the interest rate cycle and we're heading back down, we probably have seen the top of the market for cap rates, meaning the bottom of the market for pricing. Last quarter, I think it was CBRE published their quarterly assessment that cap rates had increased by 1 basis point, which is the smallest increase over the last couple of years. That to me tells me that the market is peaked, which means that if it starts heading down as it should when interest rates do, values will rise. And we see a really good entry point right now and a really good opportunity for some pretty good appreciation, which could get our returns up into the upper teens, 18, 19% on a safe platform.
Interesting. Can you talk a little bit more about your fundraising process if anybody's looking to raise equity for their projects, you know, whatever ventures they're working on? How do you approach it? What's the process that you would recommend?
I can certainly tell you the mistakes I've made, because those are more plentiful than the mistakes I've made on the real estate side. The most important thing, you know, we didn't start with an angel investor or a bell cow that was going to put 10 or 20 million into the deal to kind of feed it and get people along. I'd say going backwards, I probably would look for that first. It's a little more difficult to raise money on a retail basis than it is if you've got that first good chunk of money, because that tells investors, hey, there's somebody that believes in you and they're willing to go along with what you're doing. We didn't have that, so we had to do it the more difficult way. We early on hired an investment bank to represent us. And I think the best advice I can give to anybody is to understand what those, whoever you're hiring, whether it's a finder, a bank, there's plenty of people out there and they all want money up front and they all want to tell you great things. It's who have you raised money from and for what? Because we knew early on that we're a first time. We are not going to be attractive to institutional investors. That's just not where we are. I'm not trying to cater this product to institutional investors. If I got one, I'd be ecstatic. Most of them have a mandate that they can't deal with a first-time manager. So it gets really important to understand, well, what's the base of clientele that this group is going to reach out to? For us, it's high net worth individuals and family offices, maybe endowments. I didn't do the right research. I won't say I didn't do enough. I did do a lot of research, but I didn't do the right research when we signed the first group to raise capital. And we wasted a good chunk of time getting nowhere. Now, the very first questions out of my mouth are, who have you raised the money for? You know, who are you going to go to? How is this going to translate into what I'm doing? And even more importantly, before I give you any money, and I'd prefer not to give any money up front if I don't have to, but even if I have to, have you talked to your investors to see whether my project is palatable? I mean, I don't want to take this on, gee, I'm a great guy. I know how to raise money. I'm going to raise money for you. I want to know that you actually have people that you talk to that have money, that are investors, that really are interested in what we're doing. Because ultimately, that's where the rubber meets the road. They can be the greatest fundraisers in the world, but if they don't have somebody that wants the kind of thing that we're doing, it won't matter. They're going to be interested in what we're doing.
That's good advice. Mike, is there anything else we should be talking about that we haven't covered yet?
We've definitely covered a lot of ground. Certainly, if anybody wants to get a hold of me, they can email me at mike@guardian-advisory.com. I think the biggest topic for the day, though, really is the interest rate environment. I think that plays heavily on everything we do in the real estate market. I happen to be sitting with one of the chief investment guys for City National Bank, CNB Rochdale, actually the parent company. And I said, I just don't understand the Fed's thinking, because housing makes up a significant portion of the inflation. And if you ask anybody who's in the real estate business, the surest way to have prices come down or have rents come down is to have somebody build something next to you. And you can't build with high interest rates. So it's almost counterintuitive. Why isn't the Fed looking at this saying, we need to get rates down so that we can create more housing supply, which will naturally bring the housing inflation down? I've never understood it. Maybe someday somebody can explain it to me, but certainly this Fed doesn't get that concept.
I was recently listening to an economic podcast, and they were forecasting continued rise of inflation going forward. They're apolitical economists, right. So I tend to listen to their advice, but they were saying that because the inflationary pressures are still there and the slowdown in the economy has not really materialized, there's no reason for the Fed to lower interest rates. And in fact, they were forecasting that regardless of what Fed decides to do in this cycle, and we're in July of 25, there is going to, the inflationary pressure is going to stay, and they are anticipating interest rates to go up to continue fighting that inflation in the next couple of years. So I don't know. We'll see. You know,
I was reading somewhere where it said to get a dozen eggs from the chicken to the store, you touch petroleum something like 7 times. So as we drill more oil and the gas prices continue to come down, you know, that's going to have a deflationary pressure on the economy. I think that everybody's willing to opine as to what tariffs are going to do for inflation. I haven't heard as many people talk about what the whole artificial intelligence boom, I mean, we're early. I'm always a guy who likes to, you know, you try it, tell me how it works. If it works great for you, then I'll stick my toe in the water. I don't want to be the lead guy trying to figure all this out. But I think that ultimately, you know, we're going to get there. And, you know, you put on top of that, I think President Trump made some comment the other day that suggested that maybe they in Congress will finally figure out a way to get a guest worker program put together, at least for the trades that are highly dependent upon foreign workers. That'll have a deflationary pressure on wages, because right now there just aren't enough workers to do all the jobs. And that's before all the investment that they're talking about coming into the country and all this manufacturing. And where are those workers going to come from? So right. There's a lot of things at play. Looking backwards, we'll be able to know exactly what we should have thought, but looking forwards, it's always a little more difficult.
Exactly. It's always hard to predict. Nobody has the crystal ball, but that's why we manage our risks and manage our expectations and try to hedge our bets and hope for
Absolutely.
The best,
right?
All right. Mike, hey, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate your insights, and we'll have your contact information and show notes. Thank
Absolutely,
you very much.
Eugene. Enjoy.
Thank you. And if this conversation gave you new clarity or tools to move forward in your development journey, the best way to say thanks is to subscribe and leave a great review. That helps more people like you find the show and join the conversation. Thanks for being part of Real Estate Development Land to Legacy. When the state develops-